Chapter 2. He was glad to look from the dark streets at last, and see the light shine from his windows. Isabeau, with a Krasnoyer's instinct for good cheer, had put up red curtains, which he'd got for a few pennies as mill ends. The candlelight shone rosy through them. Itali felt his heart lighten a little. At least he was not alone here. Isabeau was a good fellow, with his loyal heart and his red curtains. He climbed the unlit staircase and turned off at the second landing. A baby was crying, a thin, almost ceaseless wail on the floor above. As he felt with his key for the lock, he thought he heard Isabeau call something, "Come in," or "Don't come in." As he hesitated, startled, the door was opened abruptly from within. He saw Isabeau standing by the table, and other men in the room, one at the door, not a foot from him. His first action was to step back and turn. A man stood behind him, halfway up the stairs. His conscious reaction was to the fixed, staring look on Isabeau's face. This troubled him, and he said, "What's wrong, Augustine?" The boy did not answer. The man holding the door open said, "Mr. Sordi, who are you? Please come in." Itali came in, followed by the man who had been on the stairs. The man who had opened the door closed it carefully, taking the trouble not to be noisy, rather like a butler, Itali thought. "You are Itali Sordi, employed by the journal Novesma Verba of Krasnoy, is that correct?" "Yes." Isabeau was looking down now, still with a stuporous expression. The other men stood wooden-faced, a lot of posts. "Will you sit down, gentlemen?" Itali said in a clear, harsh voice. They all went on standing. None of them looked at his face. "Stand if you like," he said, and sat down in his usual chair by the table. "Are you the author of these writings, Mr. Sordi?" They were his last dispatch to Krasnoy, two articles and a private letter to Brelave. "When I saw them last, they were sealed," he said, and leaned back in his chair a little to keep himself sitting down, to keep his rage under control. "Is opening mail your profession, or do you do it for pleasure?" "Did you write them?" "Who are you?" "My name is Arase," the man said with annoyance. He had a tenor voice, an intelligent, inexpressive face. "And mine's Sordi, as you know. That gives you no right to ask me questions, I think. Who are you? And am I under arrest or merely being intimidated?" "You're under arrest, Mr. Sordi, and I think the rest of this can wait." "All right, Gavral." One of the others, a somber man in his 20s, nodded. "You'll want your coat, Mr. Isabeau. This room will be sealed until you've stood trial, Mr. Sordi. You might want to bring along a change of clothing." "Let me see your authority." Arase produced a warrant signed by Castuso, commander of the Polana militia. Isabeau still had not moved. Itali went to him. "Come on, Augustine," he said. And then lower, with irritation, "Don't freeze like a rabbit. Get your coat." Tears started in the boy's eyes, and he whispered, staring at Itali, "Sordi, I'm sorry. Come on, get your coat." They rode in a closed cab through the dark, rain-swept streets, uphill to the building Itali had seen when he first entered the city, the courts of law. Its crenellated tower loomed up through sweeping clouds of half-frozen rain, dizzying in the flare of the cab lamps. In a warm, shabby room without windows, Arase interrogated them briefly before a secretary. "Very good, Mr. Sordi," he said, rubbing his hand over his forehead as if he had a headache. "Thanks. You and Mr. Isabeau will be detained here until trial. What are the charges against us? Article 15. Activities prejudicial to public order. It's a very common charge, Mr. Sode. He was not bad, this Arasi. Polite, tired, matter of fact. I know. How long is it likely to be before we stand trial? I can't say. Possibly in a few days. Usually within 2 months. Arasi bowed. Two militiamen came at his signal and took Itali and Isabeau off down a corridor, up three flights of stone steps and to a dark room at the end of a last curving corridor. They entered the room, the soldiers with them. Gentlemen, please, you carry knives, penknives, any metal instrument? The accent, as usual, was foreign, German or Bohemian. Isabeau mechanically surrendered his penknife. Itali as mechanically did not. In fact, he was surprised to find it in his pocket next morning. Very good. Good night, gentlemen. The door of the room closed with a loud, peculiar click. What do... Itali began. And then backed against the door with a start, seeing a faceless figure rear up from a couch or bench from almost under his left hand. It gave a kind of groaning snarl. The only light in the room came from a lamp or candle down the corridor, reflected dimly on the ceiling through a grating high in the door. Everything was high. The ceiling, 18 or 20 feet. The door, 10 or 12. A queer effect of the faint, wavering light. The shapeless figure on the bench pushed its face out of blankets, though no features were visible, and said, "Cellmates?" Only at the word did it occur to Itali that this curious room was a prison cell. "Right," he said, interested. But he had to turn and give his attention to Isabeau, who had crouched down onto his heels and was rocking back and forth, saying nothing. Itali talked to him, but he squatted there silent, swaying. At last, Itali hauled him up by the arm, by main force, and said, "Sit down," pushing him onto the bench that ran around two walls of the room. "Get hold of yourself." He was rough, and his voice was very angry. The boy sank his head into his hands and burst into tears. "How long were they there before I came?" Itali asked him after a while, casting about for some hook of simple fact to draw Isabeau out of his formless and grotesque abasement. "I don't know. An hour." He tried to stop sobbing. "I don't know." "What did they ask you?" "I don't know. I tried not to answer." "Oh, Jesus, Mary." He clenched his hands over his face. "I'm sorry, Itali. I'm sorry." "Look, Augustine, they're trying to frighten us. Don't give them that pleasure." "I believe you, gentlemen, are politicals," said the third man, sardonic, still faceless in the shadowy deep room. "Yes. My name's Sode." He did not know if giving your name was prison etiquette. He did not introduce Isabeau, who was still crying. "Sode, from Krasnoy." "Yes, what an honor. Not surprised, perhaps, but honored." The man gave an edgy, ingratiating snicker. "I'm Jivan Forost. I'll be out in a few days, and you gents will have more room." "Is this St. Lazare prison?" Itali asked, remembering the two tarred buildings, the court and the jail, adjoined. "St. Lazare? Are you joking? This is the court's tower. This is no jail, look at it. A palace. Blankets, light, window, all the comforts. Thought you political gentlemen knew more about the inside of jails than that." "What's wrong with Sonny?" Forrest got up, trailing the blankets he had cocooned himself in, and approached them. "Let him be," Itali said stiffly. "Needs his mammy," Forrest said. "All right. So long as he doesn't keep it up all night. Choose your beds. Plenty of room. In Laser, there'd be 40 in a room like this. Piss pots in the corner. Sleep well, gents." He rolled himself up again in his blankets and was silent. Itali talked a little while softly with Isabeau, persuaded him to lie down, and then did the same himself, feeling suddenly dead tired. Forrest had not shared his blankets with them, but the bench was covered with a burlap matting, and the air, though cold, was still fresh and still. Itali stretched out and at once felt comfortable. He closed his eyes. All his thoughts escaped him, and he fell into a sound and peaceful sleep. Forrest was with them for a week. He never said what he'd been arrested for. He was apparently some kind of clerk, but was vague about that too. He was certain of being released, and was indeed released at the end of the week. "Friends in power," he said with his snicker. He gave them detailed descriptions of the Saint-Lazare prison, without ever saying if he had been jailed there, or visited it, or spoke from hearsay. The wards of 20 to 100 men, sick and well, sane, insane, and imbecile, murderers and petty thieves altogether, the rats, fleas, lice, bedbugs, the typhus, typhoid, and smallpox that twice in the last 40 years had, in Forrest's phrase, cleaned out the prison. The solitary cells, and the cells below street level, where the water was a foot deep on the floor in winter. "That's a real prison," Forrest said with admiration. "But see, you gents don't fit. Rioters, sure. They get locked up in the wards in Lazare. Commoners, working men. Lock 'em up. Who cares? But you, gentlemen politicals, they don't want you on their hands. You too aren't going to stand trial yet for a while. They don't want to bring you up and sentence you. See, because they don't know where to put you when you're sentenced. They get orders from the government from Krasnoy. Give this one a sentence. Then they're in for it. They have to do it. But God knows where they stick him. So the longer you wait, the safer you are. You'll wait 6 months, then be released without trial. That's how they like to do it. Cool you off a while here in the tower, then let you out. You run off quick, and they don't have to worry about you anymore." Itali listened with interest, but no particular emotion. 6 days, or 6 months. There was nothing he could do about it, and probably, as Forrest implied, it was just as well that he could not. He thought of his escapade in Solarie, and the house arrest that had been his punishment. This was not all that much worse. He lay back on the bench, his shoes for a pillow, looking up at the single window set high in the high wall, and sang under his breath, "All the best governments have replaced common sense with Van Muller and Haller and Gentz." "Go on," said Forrest, who was paring his nails with Itali's penknife. "Give us a concert." "How would you like? Beyond this darkness is the light, O liberty, of thine eternal day." Forrest grinned. Isabeau looked scared. He was still depressed, brooding miserably most of the time. "What do they sing where you come from?" "Not jail songs." "What do you sing here?" He began the song he had heard at Eston, in Rakava, beneath the high walls, knowing only the first line. Forrest picked it up in a sweet tenor. "That's no jail song." "That's an old song," he said, when he'd sung it. And he began a monotonous and obscene ballad, to which Itali listened, grateful for any entertainment. He liked Forrest for never complaining. When Forrest was released and left them with a jaunty bow and a goodbye, "Good luck, Robespierre. Don't cry for me, sonny," Itali was sorry to see him go. At this point, cheerful degradation was worth more to him than noble gloom. He did not hold against Forrest his flat refusal to try and smuggle out a message to Itali's friends. Forrest had no reason to take risks, no hope of profit from the game Itali was playing. Still, the isolation worried him. The not being able to write to any of his friends, his family. "I'm here. I'm all right." Isabeau, sensing his low spirits, fell into one of his hits of apathetic, self-accusing despair. An hour passed in total silence. Itali fell asleep and slept an hour or more. When he woke, Isabeau was sitting in the same position, brooding. Itali felt a spasm of hatred, of loathing for him, which terrified him by its intensity. He turned away, as well as one could turn away from another person in the featureless room, and began to whistle the tune of a Mozart rondo Louisa had used to play. He stood up. "I have to do something. I have to move," he said. "I need exercise. Can we get up to that window? See if you can stand on my shoulders. Come on." So the guard, bringing their evening soup and bread, found Isabeau balanced on Itali's shoulders, clinging to the bars of the window, describing the view. "Stop that! Stop them! Guards!" The soldier, a big Swabian, shouted, startling Isabeau, so that he fell rather than jumped down. Itali began to laugh. "You cannot escape. You must not do that. It's forbidden," the guard roared. Isabeau, too, began to laugh. "Escape? Are we 3 inches wide?" Itali said. The Swabian, embarrassed, motioned away the other guard that had come at his call. "It's forbidden, gentlemen. I'm sorry, forbidden. No climbing." Itali stifled his laughter. Isabeau snickered, both of them exhilarated by the physical exertion and by the guard's discomfiture. After that, they took turns daily on each other's shoulders to look out at the jumbled view of rooftops and the winter sky. Itali's turns were short, as Isabeau could not long support his 150 pounds. The boy's health was shaky. An orphan, born in the waterfront slums, fed by parish charity and housed by luck, he'd not had a good start in life. The flour soup they got gave him colic, and racking headaches kept him wakeful in the night. One such night, their 18th in the cell, both were awake. As the almost jovial serenity, the acceptance mood of the first days wore away, he began to suffer from the frustration of all physical and mental energies. Itali had become, as if in compensation, more patient with Isabeau's lassitude. Compunction and compassion were strong in him this night, and when he heard Isabeau move and sigh, he sat up and asked, "Headache?" "Yes." "Do you mind if we talk a minute?" Isabeau propped himself up on his elbow. It was never fully dark in the tower cell, or fully light. Itali saw him only as a dim shape. "I wanted to say that I'm sorry I got you into this. All of this. I have meddled with your life. I had no right. At first it made this harder for me, realizing that I'd pulled you in after me, that it was my fault. But what I wanted to say now is that all the same, I'm glad you're here. I don't know how I'd get through this without you, without your friendship. That's what it comes down to. I'd rather be here with you than free if you were here, the boy said urgently, with relief. I'd rather we were both anywhere else, but as it is. That was all they said. Isabeau soon slept. It was cold in the deep room. The first heavy snow had fallen that day on the city outside their narrow window. Itali huddled under the thin blanket, wearing his coat, and when he finally got to sleep, he dreamed vividly. Most of his dreams these 18 nights had been of open places, familiar faces and voices, the mountains. This dream began in horror. He was in the tower cell, trying to wash his hands, which were dirty, as were the walls and floor, with a sort of soot or black charry grease. The wash basin was filled with acid, printer's acid, such as they used in the shop where Novesma Verba was printed. "I'll wash it off," Forrest said. "I can't use this," he explained. "This is printer's acid." "It's not acid, Amadei," Estenska told him with a sneer. "Look there. It's not eating away the basin. What are you afraid of?" But from the lip of the basin, a fine, yellowish smoke was rising. The metal disintegrated, and smoking acid ran out over the table and over his hands, eating tracks in them like worm tracks in wood, painlessly. Then he was kneeling down, staring into a pool of water, into which the disintegrated pieces of the basin had fallen. His arms were bare, plunged up above the elbow in the cold, dark green water which was slowly rising. The dim, clear surface came nearer and nearer his eyes. He looked up with a great effort. The water stretched on, quiet and deep, shining darkly, a lake. Above it, and reflected on its surface, was one immense shadow of a mountain, the Hunter. The reflection reached close to his eyes. Behind it, in the water and in the air, was nothing. The vast, pale, empty gulf of the sky after sunset. He woke. He was shivering. The pale light of snow was reflected on the high ceiling. One of the guards told them that day that they were to stand trial the following day. Isabeau in the morning and Itali in the afternoon. Isabeau's spirits went up this time, while Itali's went down. If Forrest had known what he was talking about, the later their trial came, the better. He kept his misgivings to himself and sent Isabeau off next morning with the guards, trying to believe, or at least to act, as if he believed that everything would be well. Isabeau returned before noon. "Released!" he shouted before the guard had got the door unlocked. "Released!" A rush of unexpected, overwhelming relief, joy, hope, welled up in Itali. He hugged Isabeau, his eyes filled up with tears. "You're free, then. You're free. I'm to be out of Rakava tonight and out of the Polana by Wednesday noon. Do they think I'm likely to stay the fools?" He laughed a long, shaky, triumphant laugh. Itali hugged him again, jubilant, laughing. "I didn't really hope... Thank God. Thank God. But what are you back here for?" "I asked to come back till you're through." They agreed. "They're not as bad as I thought they'd be. Let me tell you about the trial." He did, excitedly and not very coherently. As they talked, Itali's mind began to recover from the shock of hope. "A defense attorney who's never even talked to us," Isabeau said. "It's a farce. What kind of justice is that?" "Imperial justice," Itali said. "What did he say, Augustine? Anything?" "Oh, he talked about my youth and inexperience, a lot of rigmarole. Nothing important. He became uneasy. He was suppressing something the attorney had said. Probably a plea that Isabeau had been led astray by older men. Isabeau's mind was quick at apprehension, and he knew that Itali had picked up his omission. After that, they were ill at ease with each other, pretending confidence. Yet, Isabeau had been released, set free, his trial a mere formality. It did not matter what the attorneys said or did not say. When the Swabian came to take Itali to the courtroom, Isabeau came with them. He was barred from entering the court, and they did not even shake hands in the hallway outside the courtroom, as Itali was hurried on by a second guard. In the courtroom, the defense, a tall, sad-eyed lawyer on state pay, consulted with Itali for 5 minutes. "It's all about these papers, you see. These articles you wrote. We'll admit that you wrote them." "I signed them." "Of course I wrote them." "Yes, then you spoke to a workmen's meeting on the 7th and again a different group on the 20th. "Yes." "Yes, well, we'll just admit that and throw ourselves on the mercy of the court. The charge is activity prejudicial to..." "I know the charge." "What can I expect from the mercy of the court?" "Don't ask to speak," the lawyer said, looking down at the papers and scratching his lined, ill-shaven cheek. "Believe me, Mr. Sordi, don't try to defend yourself." Itali knew he was right. The prosecution and defense took about a quarter of an hour. The three judges conferred and talked with one another most of the time. When the two lawyers had finished reading their case, the judge on the left asked something of a clerk, took up a sheet of paper, and read in a loud voice, "On this evidence, and the defendant's confessions, and on the recommendation of the chief of the national police in Krasnoy, under Article 15 of the law of the 18th of June 1819, this court judges the defendant Itali Sordi guilty of the crime of inciting and participating in activities prejudicial to the public order, peace, and safety, and sentence him to 5 years' imprisonment without labor, the sentence to be effective without delay." He laid the paper down and spoke again to the clerk. Itali sat waiting. He thought the judge was going to speak again, say something else. The lawyer for the defense, sitting beside him, muttered something, shaking his head. There was a scraping of chairs. The judges got up and left, two of them still deep in talk. The guards who had brought Itali into the courtroom reappeared, jerky and wooden-like figures that appear across a clock face at the hour. "Get up, sir," one of them was saying. Itali realized he had said it before. He got up. He looked for the lawyer for the defense to ask him what was happening, but the lawyer was gone. None of the courtroom officials were left but the clerk, still writing under the judge's long desk. "Come on," the guard said, and in front of one guard and behind the other, he left the courtroom, went down a hall, and outside for the first time in 3 weeks, into a snowy yard where the frozen wind, the east wind of the Polana, cut his breath off short. His eyes watered in the cold. He looked up in bewilderment. They were between two enormous black buildings, crossing a courtyard with an iron fence. Itali stopped. "Let me see Isabeau," he said. He heard his voice thin as a boy's in the wind. "What's that?" "My friend Isabeau. He was tried this morning." "Not now, sir." "Where's he to go, Thomas?" "Ask Gainey," said the guard behind. He's specially recommended, the first guard said doubtfully. Yes, specially recommended. Ask Gainey. Here, watch your step. Itali, turning, had slipped on the ice. The guard's grab at his arm off-balanced him, and once more he went down hard on his hands and knees on the stones of Rakava. He scrambled to his feet, and the guards let him into St. Lazare, walking blindly with his head back, very erect. His head rang, and there was a taste of blood in his mouth. When he became clearly aware of the world again, he found himself in a small, dark, cold room. Light came in faintly through a grating high up in the door. The ceiling was high. He was standing up. He had been measuring the length and width of the room in paces, he realized. It was 4 paces by 3. There was a sleeping bench long enough for one person, and underneath it an earthenware basin covered with a shingle. It was cold, the damp, heavy cold of a cave or cellar, but the air was close. Down the corridor, outside the door, a baby was crying, a thin, angry, ceaseless squall. He kept thinking that it was the baby he'd heard crying when he climbed the stairs the night he was arrested. That was stupid. It could not be the same baby. He went to the door and tried to look out, but could see nothing but the wall of the passage opposite. He stood there a long time. He did not want to sit down. If he sat down, it would seem that he was going to stay here. A guard came and unlocked the door. Not a soldier, but a civilian prison guard. A big old man, taller than Itali, with a square grey face. He asked Itali to change clothes. I don't want these, Itali said, looking at the heap of grey clothing the guard had put down on the bench. Regulation, sir. You can keep your coat. I don't want this stuff, Itali repeated. He heard his voice shake. He was ashamed. I want... He began to cover his confusion and stopped. They'll keep your things for you, sealed up. It's regulations, the guard said. Like Arasi, he had the coercive yet reassuring manner of a good servant, so that Itali obeyed him, beginning to unbutton his shirt, since he was expected to change his clothes. I want something to write with, he said. What's that, sir? Paper, ink, something to write with. Have to request that of the governor of the prison, sir. You're specially recommended. Like the other guards, he said these two words in a respectful, portentous tone. His voice was rather loud and flat. He was probably somewhat deaf. Itali noticed this. He identified the grey material of the prison shirt and trousers as the rewoven stuff they called shoddy in the mills here. He noticed and thought vividly and quickly, but none of it hung together. He did not understand. That baby, crying, he said. Why is there a baby here? Born here, sir. The mother's in one of these solitaries, like your honour. She'll be sent back to the ward soon. The guard gathered up Itali's things, handing him back his waistcoat. Keep that if you like, sir. For the warmth, he said. He was respectful and kindly, if he went out and locked the high door behind him. The prison clothes were loose and rough, without much warmth. He put on the waistcoat and his plum-coloured coat, which was creased and somewhat grimy after the 3 weeks in the tower cell, but warm, and the silken sleeve lining touching his hand as he put it on gave him a moment of pure comfort. He sat down again. He had been in the tower for 3 weeks, 21 days. That was over now. The judge had said something. He had said something about 5 years. But that did not mean 5 years in prison. That was impossible. 5 years, after all, that was a very long time. He would be 30 at the end of it. 3 weeks had gone on and on. 3 weeks was enough. This was December, then January, then February. He succeeded in stopping himself from reciting the 12 months. The guard brought soup, the same flour soup. He ate it. The bowl was taken away. After a time, the light in the corridor was put out, and in the cell. It was totally black, for a while, until the eye learned to see the faintest hint of form, the dull stone echo of some distant lamp, and to cling to that. The night passed, and did not pass. Sometimes his mind worked fast, excitedly, and sometimes it did not work at all. His heart pounded and pounded, paused, pounded. He tried to count minutes by his heartbeat. He was afraid he was going mad. In this darkness, without event, swollen with the empty time, to come the hot sting of the vermin that swarmed in the bench matting was welcome. It was life. He was worn out by that night when the day came, and dozed all morning, lying contentedly enough on the bench. In the afternoon, a pair of guards came and took him out to a courtyard for exercise. It was a small inner courtyard, 40 or 50 feet square. The snow had been trodden into a firm, greyish-black floor, holed and stained yellow with urine against the walls. The two guards watched 5 prisoners, who were not permitted to speak to one another. One of them was taking his exercise methodically, trotting round and round the court, pumping his arms. His legs moved oddly, in short steps. Itali knew that this was the right thing to do, but he could not make himself do it. His legs were shaking. He must get control of himself. He must try to keep himself fit. He would plan how to use this time in the open air, and also try to exercise himself in the cell. To plan the time, and measure it out, and use it, that was the thing to do. Right now, even if it was very difficult, he should walk once around this courtyard, and breathe the clean air as deep as he could. He started out. One of the guards stopped him as he came by, a thin, red-faced man. "Was that the fellow stood trial with you, that hopped?" His dialect was heavy, and he was missing most of his teeth. Itali was not sure he'd understood the words. "Isabe?" the guard said. "Isabe, what about him?" "Was he crazy? He had a release, didn't he?" "What do you mean?" "What did he want to do that for?" "Jesus, what a thing to do. 80 feet down. Was he crazy?" "Shut up, Anto," the other guard said, with a chopping gesture, and Itali walked away from them. He longed to kneel down and put his hands into the snow, get his hands and wrists cold, ice cold, but the stuff was hard-crusted and dirty. The guards called the prisoners. He came last, feeling the others looking at him, unable to look at them. He was locked into the cell. He lay there on the bench. He did not think of Isabel, but of Estenska, of one of the days they'd gone shooting in the woods of Esten. He could see how Amadei had looked and hear the tone of his voice so clearly that he said his name aloud, very softly, but the sound of his voice frightened him. He put his head into his folded arms and lay still. The colour and smell and feel of his coat was familiar. He held on to the double thickness of the cuff, seeking reassurance. "Come on. Come on, sir." "Where now?" he said, sitting up, sick and angry. "Let me alone." "Smith's shop, sir," the guard said in his loud, toneless voice. Come on. When Itali understood, he took hold of the bench with both hands as he sat on it, and said with a kind of gasping laugh, No, I won't come on. Not there, I won't. I won't put my own neck in the collar. It's regulation, sir. Has to be done. No, Itali said. The deaf guard called to others. Adept and without much brutality, they pinioned Itali, frog marched him to the prison smithy, held him while the smith welded the loose ankle fetter onto his leg, brought him back to the little dark cold room, fastened a short length of chain between the fetter and hasp set into the wall, and left him. He was trembling and cursing in tears. Sorry, sir, the deaf guard said as he left. You'll get used to it.